Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I'm Jonathan Capehart. Welcome to Cape Up. Jonathan Metzl is back, sooner than I expected, because of the coronavirus pandemic. In his book, Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, Metzl, the director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, put a human face on the opposition to many policies that would save lives and livelihoods.
It was kind of a warning of the lengths to which white working class voters could either have underlying racism or be manipulated to vote in support of wealthy donors and corporations, but against their own lifespans. And it's just been on steroids since this pandemic started.
Listen to Metzl explain why those anti-stay-at-home protests in state capitals egged on by the president fit a historical pattern and why the politics of racial resentment is a deflection that works right now. Jonathan Metzl, thank you very much for coming back to the podcast.
It's great to be back.
So you were just on the podcast a couple of months ago, and I try not to go back to previous guests, you know, sooner than, say, 6 months. But the situation that we're in right now with COVID-19 sort of demanded that you come back. We had on Reverend William Barber talking about the racial disparities that we have now have been forced to reckon with the coronavirus. And you sent me a message sort of reminding me that everything that you wrote about in your fantastic book, Dying of Whiteness, is playing out in this coronavirus and the COVID-19 pandemic. Talk about that.
Well, the book I wrote, Dying of Whiteness, was really, I mean, who knew at the time? But what I was talking about in that book was about the ways in which there were kind of undercurrents of white racial resentment that shaped attitudes among politicians and certain white voters, particularly in middle America, that caused them to, what you would think, vote against their own biological self-interests. And so the story I told in that book was a story about how, for example, working class and lower income white voters rejected the Affordable Care Act, which would have helped them a lot, because they thought that immigrants and minorities were gaming the system. I looked at the rise of guns as symbols of kind of white self-protection. And, that was a book that I thought was kind of had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It was kind of a warning of the lengths to which white working class voters could either have underlying racism or be manipulated to vote in support of wealthy donors and corporations, but against their own lifespans. And it's just been on steroids since this pandemic started. I mean, everything from, you know, it seems like the best possible outcome for many red states would be to expand Medicaid, to give people health insurance during this moment of dire need. And you would think people would be rallying to get Medicaid. It would help them not just medically, it would help them financially, not incur bankruptcies, pay less for medications. But instead, Trump has been actively not expanding Medicaid, and people have been supporting him. The same thing with guns. The gun story is 800% rise in gun sales in some states, in conjunction with this idea, and so kind of across the board, this idea, and of course brought to bear most recently by these protests across many red states, where people are literally out there saying, we want to support Trump, even if it costs us and our family members and our communities days and months and years of our lives. And the racial currents are just absolutely unavoidable.
Okay, so let's start with those protests, because as I watched the video coming from, say, Lansing, Michigan, and other places, and people just openly defying what we all knew when they were protesting to be true, that the coronavirus is spread if you are not socially distancing, if you're not wearing a mask, if you're shaking hands, if you have any kind of physical contact. And these folks were acting in total defiance of everything we know. Are they being irrational in what they're doing, or are they being rational in that support for Donald Trump and resentment, and racial resentment are enough for them to ignore science?
Well, I think there are a couple things that are important to keep in mind about those protests. First, I just always make clear when I talk about them that those protests are not all white Americans. They're not all Trump supporters. Though that's a kind of very vocal, very threatening fringe group that has gotten a lot of validation from Trump and a lot of funding from the DeVos family and other places. And so, in a way, because we're all stuck at home, it's hard to see that there are a lot of people in red states who are terrified of what those protests represent, Democrats and Republicans. And so, first of all, I think it's unfortunate, just given the way we're all, many of us at home right now, it looks like that's every Republican out there, and that's not the case. That being said, I try to avoid saying that anything is irrational. I think in my research, I came to realize that there are deep ideologies that make sense to people. I think this idea of government overreach, this idea that social programs are going to benefit immigrants and minorities and at the expense of white people, these ideas are very, very ingrained. And I think that also when you combine that with a moment of real despair, this moment of not just a risk of mortality, but also this fear of, real economic trauma, that people fall back on their deepest fears. We've seen that, the rise of Nazi Germany on down, that people, when they're the most desperate, it's not like they become the most centrist. They become the most terrified. And so at a moment like this, people fall back on extreme ideologies. It's not like everybody's going to come to the middle. And I think Trump has been very artful at manipulating those anxieties and shifting the blame in ways that I think are very dangerous. But it's not, it, I just, it's not irrational. It's based in a particular reading of reality and also lived reality for a lot of people.
One of the big stories to come out of the coronavirus coverage is the health disparities, the disparities in impact that overwhelmingly the victims of coronavirus have been African Americans and other people of color, particularly African Americans. What role do you think that plays in the mindset of people who might be looking and saying, that's affecting them, and so therefore, I don't need to be concerned about this?
Well, I think certainly that's been a framing, and it's of course true, right? In other words, many of the people who died in this early phase are immigrants, members of minority groups, people who have to go to work in conditions or live in a lot areas where there's a lot of density. And I certainly think that that led to a feeling of kind of white invincibility, especially in the people I've been interviewing, a lot of people, in this idea that, oh no, this won't touch me because this is a kind of black and brown problem. I certainly think fueled part of the feeling of invincibility surrounding this. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think there are two caveats to that narrative. First is that I guarantee you a lot of these deaths in rural white America are being underreported just because there's not great data gathering. And so I do think there's a lot of despair in rural areas that we're not hearing about. And I think the other point is because of these protests, and particularly when these red states start opening up, if they do, which seems insane, we're going to see a lot of working class white people very sick and dying. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens to that narrative when it really starts to hit home for people.
But will that narrative hit home for people? I mean, I guess the question is, does it take people being personally impacted by this before they see the utility in all the things that we've been doing now?
Well, again, I think that the one main narrative is that people become more ideological when they become more desperate. That has been true for centuries, and especially in moments of extreme crisis like this, that people, the more desperate they become, the more they fall back on whatever belief system they had before. So it's not like everybody's going to become a Democrat. But I would say that I've been tracking a lot of the stories of people who, for example, relatives of people who are out there denying the coronavirus, who then, somebody passed away in their family, and there have been, kind of a steady stream of everybody should social distance from their family, or please take this more seriously. We're sorry we didn't do it. So I do think that being impacted personally, at least anecdotally, does seem to change people's narrative.
All right, let's talk about guns, because you mentioned at the beginning of this interview about, what was it, an 800% increase?
Some gun stores. I mean, it's an unprecedented proliferation of gun sales in the country. And some sales, I was tracking up, for example, one gun store in Oklahoma that was reporting an 800% rise in gun sales. So it's absolutely unprecedented.
Unprecedented, but to your mind and given your research, not surprising.
Definitely not surprising. I mean, I think that guns have been particularly constructed as symbols of kind of a defiance, a kind of anti-government authority that has been very consciously crafted over the past 3, 4 decades by the NRA and gun manufacturers. And the other thing I think is very important is that gun sales spike in relation to the scarcity narrative. So the idea that somebody's going to come take your guns away or the gun stores are going to close, the NRA has been very effective at playing to those fears. So when else have we seen gun sales spike in the past? Well, after Sandy Hook, when you think we would want fewer guns, but people thought, oh, there's going to be gun reform, and all of a sudden gun sales spike after President Obama was elected, this narrative, he's going to come take your guns away. And if you look at the statements after the coronavirus started, President Trump was tweeting about protect your Second Amendment, it's under attack, and people were saying things like that. And so this idea that people were kind of hoarding guns like toilet paper or Purell, and I think that was that narrative is so effective. So I think that was part of it as well.
What impact do you think President Trump's now daily, and I'm just going to call them campaign rallies from the press briefing room? They're supposed to be the coronavirus task force daily briefing, but he takes them over, and a lot of the things he says, used to say at campaign rallies, he's now saying from the White House press briefing room. What impact do you think that's having on the people we're talking about?
Well, I think there's a lot of coded messaging in Trump's press conferences. I've been following this pretty closely just because it's a lot of the same language that I heard when I was doing my research. This idea that it's somebody else's fault in very racial terms, this idea that you're going to get screwed, I'm defending you as white Americans, even this kind of second civil war kind of language. There are a bunch of different silent whistles that Trump is voicing. It's not just like he's unhinged, that then get picked up by right-wing outlets. And so I think a lot of this is a kind of signaling that he's doing to groups that are then kind of taking the cue. I'm sure there's a lot of other kind of communication in that as well. But I would say that a lot of this kind of what I call in my book the rhetorics of white racial resentment is coming out in these. And I just can't say how upsetting this is for a bunch of reasons, as somebody who's written a book about this topic, but particularly because this coronavirus crisis, it really was a moment like 9/11 for George Bush or other people, that this could have been a moment where Trump really could have been a leader for everybody and brought the country together. It really represented an opportunity for him to be the kind of leader that he has said he wants to be. And I also think this coronavirus is something where it kind of demands that kind of leadership. In other words, if there are pockets of coronavirus anywhere, we're all unsafe. We're all unsafe. And so in that regard, I feel like it's not only completely irresponsible, but just a tremendous missed opportunity.
And yet we saw him at one of the earlier briefings where, when asked by a reporter if he took any personal responsibility at all for what was happening. And he said, no, I don't take personal responsibility at all. For the people who hear the president's dog whistles, either silent or not so silent, do they absolve him of any responsibility for where we are?
Well, I think that's the power of these narratives of what I call racial resentment. This idea that it's somebody else's fault is a terrific deflection, really. It works. I mean, think about the interviews I did. People were literally dying because Trump blocked the Affordable Care Act and other politicians in their neighborhoods and in their communities. And instead of saying we want to rally in support of getting health care, it was always it's somebody else's fault. And so this idea of deflection, I think, is just growing more and more powerful. And so in that sense, I think for a particular slice of the electorate, I don't think that it's going to be like, oh, we're going to have a kind of let's all turn on Trump moment. But that being said, I would also say that I think there are examples from recent politics of people who are willing to listen right now. You know, I think of the Kentucky gubernatorial election, the Louisiana gubernatorial election, elections that were before the pandemic, supposed to be won by Republicans and run by Democrats, because Democrats went in and really listened to people's concerns. And they said, you know, in very non-jargony term, here's what we're going to give you, and here's what we're going to do for you. And it was basic things, you know, healthcare, wages, things like that. And so I do think that there are people, in other words, I don't think everybody's just falling for the Trump Act right now, but I do think that the Democrats in some ways have to do a better job of speaking to economic concerns when we start to craft a narrative.
And that's a great segue to the next question I was going to ask you, because when I talked to Reverend Barber, and you know Reverend Barber, he has been talking for years about the fact that we don't use the word poverty in politics at all. We don't talk about poverty, and that it's poverty that is the common denominator for millions upon millions of Americans. Is it, if Democrats were to adopt the mantra of doing something, combating poverty in the way that Reverend Barber's talking about, he says that if you take a map of the United States and you plunk down the states where there's voter suppression, the states where there hasn't been Obamacare, the states where there isn't a $15 or a raised minimum wage, you stack all these maps on top of each other, and the states where all those things are in common are pretty much the same. So is it possible, because of coronavirus, because of the situation that we're in, that a message that's directed at alleviating poverty and inequities will be something that will win over the broadest swath of the American electorate?
Well, I do think there's absolutely, and I respect Reverend Barber so much for that message. And I think it's right in a lot of ways, that I do think that on one hand, people's economic despair is, of course, as real, and even in some instances, more real than the virus. And so the Democrats really need to do, to be honest, a better job at crafting an economic message in this time. I realize it's also a public health crisis, and I realize they're standing up for workers, but I do think that they've ceded too much of that territory in this moment. And I think that there's a moment for what you might call kind of a conservative progressive movement that basically says, we have the right to health care. We have the right to education. We have the right to safety and better wages. And I think right now is a very important moment. And I think that, you know, you can just see what kind of threat. It's not like everybody would come together maybe under one candidate, but a message like that would be very threatening to the GOP platform, just because if their base started saying we deserve living wages and health care, they couldn't give tax cuts to wealthy people in corporations. It would collapse their agenda in a particular way. So I think right now is a very important moment for that kind of progressivism that can cut across political ideology. But I would also say, because I'm somebody who studies whiteness, that there's a long history of using white racial resentment, from Du Bois's analysis on down, this idea of what's called a wage of whiteness, that working class whites have every time they've tried to move toward some kind of unity around economic issues, the race card all of a sudden comes out, and it's very divisive. And so it also needs to be a strategy for how can we overcome the divisiveness that sets people apart because of race when really they have common socioeconomic interests.
Given your research and given what we're going through with the pandemic, what concerns you the most about the time we're in now?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, but I really, it's the most obvious thing. It's right in front of us. But I think that this polarization is so powerful right now. And I don't mean just the obvious polarization, but think about it. Like we're all in our homes, many of us, or in vital jobs, but not interacting the way we used to do. And there's so many ways in which, even in our daily lives before, you know, you'd go to work, you'd meet different kinds of people, you'd go to the gym. Some, you know, my softball team, half the team was Trump supporters, half the team was libertarians, and I was, you know, the outlier.
Hello.
You know, you learn. Yeah, I'm the only guy without a gun in my bat bag on my national softball team. I'm just like, don't confuse it with the bat. But you know, you engage with people who are different than you in the regular world. And now we're all in kind of our caves. We only have social media with people who agree with us very often. We only talk to people who are our friends before this. And so the ability to kind of cut across the political aisle right now, on one hand, I really feel like polarization is a vector for illness. If we can't all come together and solve this, this is a common threat to humanity. And Trump is benefiting by fomenting polarization. And that might be a good political strategy for him as far as he's concerned, but it's a horrible strategy for how to combat this virus. If we don't all work together, you know, we're just going to keep having this virus float around for quite a long time. And so in a way, I really feel like we need strategies for reaching out to people who are politically different from us and engaging with some kind of meaningful dialogue that's not crafted by the kind of polarizing rhetoric. I think that's going to be the trick. And it's hard to do when we're physical distancing.
And then last question for you, given everything that you just said, is there anything in what we're going through that gives you hope?
I do think there are new community engagements happening. I think people are recognizing things that they took for granted before, not just about their neighbors, but about the many different supply chains and networks that enabled them to live the way they were, the workers who are involved in bringing food to people's tables or, you know, keeping places clean, keeping you healthy. And so in that sense, I do think that there's been a renewed appreciation just of not only of the networks that are involved in keeping society afloat, but also how connected we are. I mean, it's interesting how different the everyday message of coronavirus, where people are really recognizing their interconnectedness, is from the political message, which is saying, you know, red and blue are totally different, and you know, let's all be different. So it's like, so I think on the community level, there are networks forming that probably weren't formed before.
Jonathan Metzl, author of Dying of Whiteness: How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, and also director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. Thank you very much for coming back to the podcast so soon.
My honor. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.